I found a report that detailed the movement of chemical weapons from depots and storage areas in the United States in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, that noted that some chemical weapons were disposed of at sea.
If you look at the lake, I mean, everybody's first response is, there's no munitions there. I can't see them. I see this beautiful lake. How can you have munitions? Reality, they're there, and we're paying a price for them.
Time bombs are ticking under the sea. 1 million tons of unused chemical weapons lie on seabeds all over the world, and their contents are leaking. This is an unknown story that cutting-edge science and newly declassified documents are now bringing to light.
Chemical weapons in various forms have a very ancient lineage, but their main military usage has derived from the First World War, where they're used in very substantial quantities. The first major gas attack of any significance was the use of chlorine gas during the First World War across a 6 kilometre front at the Second Battle of Ypres, launched on 22nd of April 1915. Other gases are introduced, but the big breakthrough is in 1917 when mustard gas is used for the first time and it becomes known as the king of the war gases.
The new weapons attacked the body inside and out. First affected were the eyes with a severe burning sensation. Then there would be a painful swelling of the lids, followed quickly by blindness, sometimes permanent, caused by ocular clouding. The lungs were assaulted on a cellular level, prompting coughing, bleeding, blistering of tissue, resulting in respiratory distress, pulmonary edema, and death up to 10 days after exposure. The most noticeable effects were on the skin, where red lesions appeared before erupting into raised blisters filled with yellow liquid, severely painful to the touch.
The interwar period is a very strange period for chemical warfare. Most of the programs are secret, and the intelligence agencies know very little about the extent and depth and the innovations. And like intelligence agencies the world over, that when you don't know the truth, you assume the worst.
This is a new arsenal started at the beginning of the present emergency. It is now in production and can manufacture more mustard gas in one day than was manufactured by us in all of World War I.
The Americans acquire eventually something like 51 million chemical shells, or 1 million chemical bombs, 100,000 spray tanks ready for a chemical war. I mean, their reproduction is colossal, 135,000 tons of gas.
The chemical war that everyone was expecting never took place. At the Potsdam Conference, the victorious Allies decided to split up the enemy's stocks and dump them in the seas. This was considered the safest alternative at the time, and they imposed official secrecy on this policy until 2008. Dumpings took place all over the world, in the Sea of Japan, the Indian Ocean, the Baltic Sea, the North Sea, the North Atlantic, and off the Côte d'Azur in France. Our investigation began in Italy with sea dumping in the Mediterranean. Those dumpings were unknown by the public until Gianluca Defoe, a reporter from Milan, broke the story in his best-selling book, Poisons of State. Documents uncovered by Defoe revealed never-before-known details of how chemical weapons from both sides in the war ended up in the sea. As far as the Italian weapons are concerned, on the Allied side, it was a daring air raid that brought their chemical weapons to the seas. On December 2nd, 1943, the German Luftwaffe bombed the port of Bari, and it unknowingly provoked the biggest chemical disaster in the Mediterranean. The Allies kept secret their chemical weapons shipment for fear of handing the Nazis a huge propaganda victory. This secrecy hindered efforts to effectively treat hundreds of Italian citizens affected when a cloud of sulfur mustard gas wafted over the city. We find a similar situation in the north of Europe and the Baltic Sea. During the Second World War, it was a theater of combat for the navies of Germany, Finland, and the Soviet Union. The Baltic is today, without doubt, considered the most polluted sea in the world. Cold War politics were a major obstacle to the scientific study of the effects of chemical munitions in the Baltic. With the fall of the USSR, Baltic states were now free to do the work. The Polish Academy of Science began ChemSci.
We are 11 institutions all around the Baltic Sea. Countries like Sweden, Finland, Germany, Lithuania and Poland. Now the Baltic Sea bottom become a resource. There are more and more pipelines, windmills, cables and so on being laid on the sea bottom. So it's not really safe to proceed without better knowledge. We are basically performing a risk assessment for the dumped munitions from the Second World War, which resides on the Baltic Sea bottom. And we are trying to assess the location of munition, the pollution of the bottom around it, and the impact it might have on the ecosystem. We are at the Bornholm Deep dump site. It's the biggest single dump site in the Baltic Sea. It's about 30,000 tons of munitions dumped here. They believed if we dump it in the Bornholm Deep, when we've got muddy sediments, it will not propagate to other areas of the Baltic because they thought it is totally inert area. No bottom currents, no water movement. It will stay where it is dumped. Nowadays, we know that the salt water which comes from the North Sea travels through this area and is moved to other areas of the Baltic. So if the sediments are contaminated, it can be a point source of contamination which is spreading to other areas in the Baltic. We decided to collect sediments very close to the objects, like half a meter if possible, and we can only do it with the robot, because with the robot we can take sediment samples which will be most probably contaminated with mustard gas or any other warfare agents. Sometimes you are seeing the encasements which are completely corroded and the actual agent sits on the bottom in lumps. It's leaking into the environment. We do not know the speed of leakage because some objects are completely intact and some of them are completely corroded. And it seems that sea is degrading it to more stable forms, but some of those more stable forms are equally toxic as original agents. Whereas the mustard gas decomposes to thiol-D-glycol, which can be hydrolyzed completely in the seawater to sulfur and carbon and hydrogen, so it's pretty much harmless substances. Whereas those compounds which were based on arsenic oil, they are decomposing to inorganic arsenic, finally. And arsenic is, of course, a poison. We launched like three expeditions now to the dumping sites, collecting fish, cod mainly. And what we have seen is the higher frequency of fish diseases. and also some impact on the genotoxicity, because those compounds are highly mutagenic. So our partners from Lithuania were able to see the mutated blood cells. We didn't yet, at least, detect toxic levels of arsenic in tissue, whereas we've been able to detect the arsenic in urine of fish. So it seems that it's affecting the fish health, but actually not to the extent which makes it dangerous to consumption. There are many pollutants in the environment which can cause similar effects, like organic contaminants, heavy metals, and so on. So it seems that chemical munitions are maybe not a single factor, but a factor which enhances the environmental damage.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishes are not getting injured by fishing that substances up. And therefore, we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases both in Denmark but also elsewhere in the world where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive.
Can you load in there?
We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist the fishing vessels that have caught chemical munitions. But that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms. The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on a investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s of barrels of mustard gas and lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball, laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't have any idea where they would be.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
Baltic Sea fishermen face continuing threats that dangerous bombs or leaked substances will be caught in their nets. Bornholm Island, a Danish island, is in the middle of the Baltic, close to one of the largest dump sites.
I'm fifth generation fisherman on Bornholm.
And we have manual, so we can how to deal with this. We have areas where there are dumped chemicals, weapons. The yellow one is a precautionary area, and the red is where we should be extra careful. And you have Bornholm here, you have the Baltic, Gotland in Sweden, and also an area, and a red area for extra precaution.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, you're welcome to your program for a better life with me, Javedi Akbari. In the previous episode, I discussed an important topic about morality, and I said that moral attributes, moral qualities, moral traits can be categorized into social and individual. Some of them have social aspects and some individual aspects. For example, generosity as a moral quality, chastity as a moral quality, stinginess, justice and injustice, jealousy. These are moral traits and qualities which have a social aspect. And there are also some moral qualities which have individual aspects. Like, for example, thankfulness to God, hard working, laziness, bravery. These are some qualities that have individual aspect and can be truthful for one living completely isolated from the society. Everyone in relation to his fellow human beings should maintain good conduct to others. At the end of the day, he himself will be benefited by maintaining good conduct to others. Because moral qualities have something to do with one's conduct, with one's behavior towards other people. If you are good, if you maintain good conduct towards other people, at the end of the day, you will also get benefited. Individual morality has a considerable part in respect to oneself. They are also important individual qualities or qualities, moral qualities, which have to do with the individual himself and not with the other people. They are also important. Hardworking and, of course, patience. These are important qualities. Now, there is a misconception. Some people are flawed in their understanding regarding piety, for example. Or let's say, speaking from a general perspective, they are flawed regarding morality. Those who, isolate themselves from the society for purification of morals, for purification of their souls, they seclude themselves, supposing that they can achieve and embrace moral values better in this way. These people are completely flawed. They do not have proper understanding of what piety is. Piety or morality does not mean that one should seclude himself, isolate himself from the society and not have anything to do with other people, not have to anything to do with other members of the society in order to protect himself from the society. Of course, it's wrong to banish yourself from society to avoid sins. There is no virtue at all in doing this. And it's like making yourself blind. That doesn't make sense.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Islam never endorses such practice. Piety actually has to be interpreted and translated in the context of one living in the society. Okay. Experience, of course, has shown that isolation and seclusion from society will cause a series of moral vices, such as peevishness, suspicion, and vanity, conceit, and so on and so forth. And that's the reason why Islam has encouraged Muslims to have a social life and to live in large cities. And that's why Islam has recommended observance. Islam has recommended the moral principles in the heart of the society. And when, for example, let's give you the example, a person living in a village and a person living in a city, which one is preferred to lead a congregational prayer? And a person living in an urban area is preferred over a person living in a rural area. That's what the religious authorities have inferred based on the narrations and the evidence found in religious literature. Dear brothers and sisters, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam says, لِلْمُؤْمِنِ ثَلَاثَ سَاعَاتٍ فَسَاعَةٌ يُنَاجِ فِيهَا رَبَّهُ وَسَاعَةٌ يَرُمَّ مَعَاشَهُ وَسَاعَةٌ يَخَلِّ بَيْنَ نَفْسِهِ وَبَيْنَ لَذَّتِهَا فِيمَا يَحِلُّ وَيَجْمُلُ. Okay, a believer should divide his time into three parts, into three portions. Okay, one part in which he should worship his God, and another part in which he should give attention to his livelihood. He should work for his family to earn his livelihood, and then another part he should detach himself actually to enjoy what is lawful and what is pleasant. Living in this world, some people are completely mistaken in their behavior and their understanding. For example, we see some people engaging in du'as and supplications and expects Allah to give them everything they wish. They do not work, there is no working, doing dua, performing dua, supplications from morning till night. There is a famous proverb in English also which says, no pain, no gain. لَيْسَ لِلْإِنسَانِ إِلَّا مَا سَعَى. The Quran also says that a person cannot gain anything and cannot achieve anything unless he works hard. And of course, if a person is lazy, if a person is stingy, if a person is not hardworking, then these qualities will have its impact on his life and on his family members. Du'as, of course, are good. Supplications are fine. But practical actions are also important. So we need to understand that unless you work hard, you will not achieve anything. I do not deny the importance of du'a. Du'as are good. Supplications are good. Communication with Allah is highly important. But we should not misunderstand the importance of du'a. We should, according to the hadith which I recited from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, we should divide our times. Our time should be dedicated to worshipping Allah, another for working hard, for earning our livelihood, and another for enjoying ourselves, living with our family, with our children. All these three have to be maintained together. Otherwise, there is something wrong with us. So inshallah, we will further continue our discussion in the following episode. Until then, wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. All I need. All I need. All I need. All I need.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. Africa Today.
Africa Day, also known as the African Unity Day, is celebrated annually on the 25th of May. It commemorates the founding of the Organization of African Unity, or OAU, Ghana's founding father, Kwame Nkrumah, who played a critical role in the formation of this pan-African organization, was a firm believer in African unity.
This decade is the decade of African independence. Forward then to independence now. Tomorrow, the United States of Africa.
Hello, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a program that gives you an incisive analysis of events taking place in Africa. Now, this week, we are focusing on the current state of the African continent, 58 years after the formation of the Organization of African Unity, the precursor to the African Union. We shall review some of the major challenges facing the continent and what the future prospects hold for this great and rising continent. And don't forget to send us your comments on this show and on our previous shows. Stay with us.
Africa Day 2021. On 25th of May 1963, Africa made history with the foundation of the Organization of African Unity, or the OAU. Africa Day is commemorated on the occasion of this great day to celebrate and acknowledge the successes of the Organization of African Unity, and now the African Union, in the fight against colonialism and apartheid. During this day, Africans also celebrate the progress that Africa has made while reflecting upon the common challenges that the continent faces in a global environment. In July 1999, during an extraordinary summit in Sirte, the OAU decided to set up a new organization to replace it. The African Union, officially launched at the Durban Summit in 2002, was tasked with accelerating and deepening the process of economic and political integration of the continent.
Speaking during the event, the then South African President Thabo Mbeki pledged that African leaders will honor commitments made during the establishment of the African Union.
We have convened at this stadium in Durban in the South African province of KwaZulu-Natal to make a pledge to the peoples of Africa and the world that we will honor the commitments we made as we agreed to establish the African Union. As a South African, I am proud that Africa is taking the giant step forward that she is taking today.
Well, so what's the state of Africa today? And have African leaders lived up to their commitments to serve the people? Now, to discuss the current state of the African continent, we are joined by Firoz Manji, a professor of African studies at Carleton University in Canada. He's also a publisher at Daraja Press. Welcome, Professor Manji.
Pleasure.
Also here with us today is Masharia Monene, a United Nations expert on decolonization and a professor of history and international relations at the United States International University in Nairobi. Thank you for having us.
My pleasure.
Now let's start off with Professor Manji. It's quite obvious that the COVID-19 pandemic will be on top of the African Union agenda this year due to its impact on the lives of hundreds of millions across the continent. Now, what is the African Union doing to mitigate this crisis, especially through the availability of vaccines?
Well, I'm afraid the balance sheet is too little too late. And they have declared plans for enabling Africa to be able to manufacture its own vaccines. But this is a plan which won't be in effect until another 20 years from now. All of this could have been done many years ago. We simply don't have the capacity to produce vaccines, in spite of the intellectual talent that exists in Africa. I think one of the most disappointing things about it all is that the very small number of vaccinations that have already been given have largely been given to the elite, to the members of the elite and middle classes.
Thank you, Professor Manji of the Raja Press.
The African Union is playing a central role in managing continental efforts to limit the health and economic impact of COVID-19. However, the availability of COVID-19 vaccines for Africa is a major challenge given the region's disproportionately low rate of vaccinations. Dr. John Nkengasong, director at the AU's Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has warned that any delay in COVID-19 vaccines will impact negatively on Africa. Let's take a listen.
Any delay in our vaccination is going to cost us not just life, but our economies. I mean, because if you take the case of South Africa, if the projection or the trends we are seeing are maintained, then South Africa would naturally go through a third wave, and that will require other drastic measures that will restrict the movement of people, will restrict the tourist industry, will restrict so many things in economic development. So that continues to impact our economy and, of course, life safety. Vaccines are the most potent tool for our economic recovery, period. I don't know how else to put it there. I mean, if we want to recover our economies, we have to invest in vaccines, and at scale and at speed. I've always said there are three things we need to do on the continent come out of this. One is fairness in vaccine distribution. Second is the speed of vaccination, and third is the scale of vaccination.
Professor Manji, now, as a follow-up to our first question, some governments in Africa are claiming that the vaccination programs are targeting citizens regardless of their social background. Now, do you agree?
It's shocking to see how many of those middle-class people have actually had access to the vaccines, whereas those most in need, the most vulnerable, those who work in hospitals, those who do the cleaning, those who are exposed to on a daily basis in occupations which put them at highest risk, they're the ones who are least able to get access to vaccines.
Now, the need to contain the COVID-19 pandemic disrupted the African Union work on silencing the guns, an ambitious goal to end conflicts in Africa by 2020. Now, the organization has extended these projects' deadline by 10 years. African Union High Representative for Silencing the Guns, Ambassador Namtane Lamamara, elaborates here on the importance of the project.
The African leaders have come to realize that very little of their ambitious project for Africa could be actually accomplished if they don't succeed in silencing the guns.
Let's now bring in Professor Munene. Now, silencing the guns, a slogan of a project that targets silencing of all illegal weapons in Africa, could not be realized by the African Union by the end of 2020 as envisaged. Now, what was the reason for the failure to meet the deadline?
Thank you very much. There are, I think, three reasons that can be given. In each of the states, particularly those that have perpetual friction, the divisions and the feuds among various factions. Second, the African Union as a body does not have the capacity to intervene properly and stop some of the things. Third, the encouragement and the conflict entrepreneurs from outside the continent to ensure that the fighting continues, because it makes it easy for them to extract the wealth that they need to do that by sponsoring some of the factions.
The formation of the African Union was precisely aimed at finding African solutions for African problems. The AU's institutions, powers, and objectives were meant to bring about fundamental shifts away from the constraints imposed on actions under the Organization of African Unity Charter.
The newly elected African Union Commissioner for Political Affairs, Peace and Security, Ambassador Bankole Adeoye, says going forward, there will be more focus on preventing conflicts.
Over the years, we have invested so much in responding to conflicts without investing our tools, our energy, our time in conflict prevention. I believe that will be the African Union, the world will be a better place for us if we promote preventive diplomacy as was championed by one of Africa's greatest sons in the past, Dr. Boutros Ghali, who also became UN Secretary General. He spoke about the emphasis on preventive diplomacy. So one of the things I'll be doing under my commissionership is to devote more energy into early warning, into preventive diplomacy, and engaging in mediation at the highest level.
Now, let's take a short break, and when we come back, we shall continue our discussion by looking at the African Continental Free Trade Area. So stay with us.
Africa Day 2021.
The African Continental Free Trade Area began operating on the 1st of January 2021 and is expected to boost African commerce, especially after the devastating effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. The African Union Commissioner for Trade and Industry, Ambassador Albert Muchanga, says the journey towards the African Continental Free Trade Area has been long.
It has been a long journey, difficult and long, but we had visionaries. When we created the Organization of African Units in 1963, President Nkrumah of Ghana made a clarion call, Africa must unite.
Back to you, Professor Munene. Now, where do you see the African Continental Free Trade Area in the next 5 years?
So there are moves to remove or minimize border obstacles so that people and goods and services can move freely from one to the other. And that is a process, a work in progress. So in the next 5 years, I see it very big, having expanded to almost every country on the continent. Right now, it does not embrace as much. And then the way things are going, having these interlinkages in terms of communications, infrastructure, the more the infrastructure between and amongst the countries, the more the inter-African trade is likely to increase. So in the next 5 years, it will be expanded to a reasonable level that many countries will feel good about.
Thank you, Professor Munene, for that positive outlook.
The African Continental Free Trade Area is supposed to provide significant opportunity for small businesses. A Ugandan trader explains here the challenges she faces in cross-border trade.
I'm selling clothes. I bought them from South Africa, Dar es Salaam, Nairobi. When I'm bringing my goods back, we have problems because they ask us to pay. But if you don't want to pay, they take your goods. When you don't have all the money, you bribe.
Do you think common people in Africa will benefit from African Continental Free Trade Area? In other words, will the benefits trickle down?
For the vast majority of people, I'm afraid this is not going to be something good. If you look at Africa in terms of food, something like 75 to 80% of food in Africa is produced by small-scale farmers, but it isn't they who are going to benefit from this. It's going to be those who own these large industrial agricultural and indeed the mining companies. They're the ones who are going to be the ones who are going to benefit from this. It allows at the transnationals to move across different borders for free. It allows the rich to make to trade, but does I fear very little for farmers or for those who are dispossessed of their land or are unemployed.
One of the major challenges facing Africa today is the presence of foreign military bases, especially those established by Western countries with a history of colonialism and exploitation. The U.S. and France are at the forefront of conducting and establishing military bases in Africa. The Western military bases are unpopular in Africa, with many citizens saying they believe these bases are a source of insecurity. A Ghanaian woman explains here on why she opposes U.S. military presence in her country.
I'm a mother, and we know what these Americans do. We know that these Americans have a lot of enemies. And by coming to settle their base here, we are not safe. And that's the reason why I have to join this campaign, to create awareness.
Now, recently, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari said that the United States should consider moving its military headquarters overseeing Africa to the continent from Germany to better tackle what he called growing violence in the region. Now, Buhari's remarks have been sharply criticized by many inside and outside Nigeria. Professor Monene, is it in the interest of African countries to have foreign military bases dotted around the continent?
It may not be in their long-run interest or in the African interest to have all these bases, competing bases, not just because they're competing bases of various powerful countries trying to show their might as they perceptibly protect their perceived interest, geostrategic interest, in using Africa as the place or the base for that purpose. So it will have to come from within the African countries in collaboration with their regional bodies and the African Union to agree that the bases are not helpful to individual countries and to the African continent as a whole.
Thank you for that insight, Professor Monene.
African Union Agenda 2063, a shared strategic framework for inclusive growth and sustainable development, was adopted in January of 2015 by the 24th African Union Assembly of Heads of State and Government. It is basically a blueprint and master plan for transforming Africa into the global powerhouse of the future. The African Union on track to achieve the objectives of Agenda 2063, which aims to transform the continent into a major global power?
The potential is there, but it is far from being realized. And in part because of the reasons we've given from the other answers, the divisions within, the external forces that would like to keep the African continent divided and fighting, and so. And then when you come to the high command, the African high command, we have some organizations that have some military aspects, but not very strong because they are also reliant on external extra-continental forces.
This year, President Cyril Ramaphosa participated in a webinar marking the Africa Day. The webinar was organized by the Prime Minister of Jamaica under the theme, A Destiny of Peace, Prosperity, Strength, and Unity. Ramaphosa had this to say on the importance of Africa Day, which brings together people of African descent from across the world.
Today we celebrate the ties that bind us together, ties that no ocean, be it the Atlantic Ocean or any other, no slave trader, no war, and no pandemic can tear asunder.
Professor Manji, you have the closing comments in our show today. Now, is Africa Day given the attention it deserves in Africa?
But you see, there are two different kinds of Pan-Africanism. The Africa Union represents the Pan-Africanism of an elite, of the oligarchs of our continent. Whereas on the ground, there are people who are organizing and connecting citizens to citizens. And it's that kind of connection between citizens and those who are perhaps the most disenfranchised, the what Fanon called the wretched of the earth, who are the ones who can benefit most from that connection Pan-African-wise.
Well, thanks a lot, Professor Feroz Manji of the Radio Press, for your incisive analysis. Unfortunately, our time is up for today. Now, welcome to this segment of our program, which brings you interesting news from different parts of Africa. Now, today we are going to Nigeria, where recently an athlete who was 8 months pregnant clinched a Taekwondo gold medal at the country's National Sports Festival. We've talked to her days after the event. Now, tell us a little bit about yourself, some background about your sporting career.
Good afternoon. My name is Mrs. Idris Aminat Mateko. I'm 26 years old, graduate of University of Lagos, studied human kinetics and health education. My sporting career started when I was pretty young. My dad is a Taekwondo coach, and Taekwondo has been a family thing, you know. Introduced Taekwondo to us and he encouraged us to train. So growing up, I got very fond of training. I love to train. I'm always happy when I have to go for training. So it's been like that up to this moment. So I'll say basically Taekwondo is in the family. So that's why I've been on track. Yeah.
Okay, Aminat, how is your experience as a hijabi woman doing professional sports?
Yeah, as a hijabi using hijab and participating in professional sports, it's been very interesting for me personally, because one of the reasons why I'm still in sports, why I'm still participating actively, is because Taekwondo allows the use of hijab globally, international, anywhere you want to go, as far as you want to go, Taekwondo allows the use of hijab. So for me personally, it's always interesting. I'm always happy. I'm representing Islam. You know, I'm out there. I'm having fun. I'm doing what I like. And I'm still properly dressed. Not just my hijab. You know, the Taekwondo outfit itself is really modest. It covers its feet. It's not tight, you know. So it allows me to be very confident and free to do whatever I have to do. So for me, it's one of the most interesting parts of being an athlete. I have to use my hijab. It doesn't deprive me.
Now, there was mixed reaction after you attended the competition while 8 months pregnant. Now, how do you feel about yourself? Why did you decide to take part in the competition, and weren't you worried about the health of your unborn child?
You know, people are entitled to their opinion. You can say whatever you want to say. No one is going to hold that against you. So, what is most important is the fact that my husband, my family members, you know, they gave their consent and go ahead. That's one. Secondly, I have been certified by medical professionals that, okay, you are physically fit, you can go ahead, because it's something I have been doing before I got married, before I got pregnant. You know, my body is already used to it. It's something I've been doing, I've been practicing. So when I got pregnant, I started training, it doesn't feel different. Then we had to seek permission from the federation as well, Nigerian Taekwondo Federation, just to be sure that there's no rule against a pregnant woman participating at the event. So, and we were sure that the World Taekwondo Federation has no conduct against it. So we had no reason to be worried. As far as I am okay, there was no reason to fear. I believe in God that my baby and I will be fine. That's how we decided to move ahead.
Well, by the way, this interview was conducted while she was pregnant, and now the good news is that Aminat Idris has already given birth to a bouncing baby girl. Well, congratulations, Aminat, for the little angel, and God bless you all. And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. We hope you enjoyed the show. It will be great hearing from you, so send us your comments through our social media handle. Goodbye for now.
The 13th presidential election. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Iran's 13th presidential election is going to be held on June 18th. Election and political participation is a way to choose an official or officials for a specific post. Election is the symbol of people's rule over their own fate. However, elections in some countries are quiet, ceremonial, and a mere show of democracy. In Iraq, there are two kinds of elections. One is the election of city councils. Each province in Iraq is considered as a domain and enjoys its specific administrative establishment and provincial council. The other election is the parliamentary election. The president is also elected by the parliament. The president should be a Sunni Kurd. The parliament speaker should be a Sunni Arab, and the prime minister should be a Shia. In Syria, the president is elected for 7 years. Parliamentary and city council elections are other elections that are held in this country. In Kuwait, there are elections for city councils and parliament. The parliamentary election functions stronger in this country in comparison with other Arab countries in the region. Saudi Arabia is the only country which has not experienced any elections so far. The monarchic regime has never allowed the people to go to ballot boxes to elect their desired officials. The United Arab Emirates has a parliamentary election every 4 years, which is totally ceremonial, as the parliament has no power before the royal family. Bahrain is just like the UAE. Yusuf Al-Huri, Bahraini political activist, says on democracy in the Arab countries of the Persian Gulf region, "The fact is that the systems of the Arab countries of the Persian Gulf region have not come to power on the basis of election. The ruling systems in these countries have rather come to power by colonialist systems like Britain, and they are supported by this country so that they may be able to continue their rule and exchange interests with each other. Today, we know it well that it is the British who caused Al Khalifa to rule in Bahrain and have supported them so far," unquote. Dear listeners, the same is true with Saudi Arabia. The system of governance is almost the same in Kuwait, UAE, and Qatar. In Qatar, the only election that is held is related to the city councils. But in Oman, as a royal system, the members of parliament are elected by people. In Lebanon, there are three kinds of